Action, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Support for today's broadcast comes from New Prairie Construction. Serving the Champaign-Urbana area since 1988, they specialize in remodeling, additions, historic restoration, and straw bale construction. You can learn more about New Prairie Construction on their website, newprairieconstruction.com.
It is 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. We were scheduled this afternoon to speak with William Hensley, author of 50 Miles from Tomorrow, a memoir of Alaska and the real people. We're going to have to reschedule this program, this interview. So this afternoon, what we're going to do is we'll go to the archives and we'll rebroadcast an interview from November of this year, of last year, excuse me, with Leonard Todd, author of Carolina Clay, The Life and Legend of the Slave Potter Dave. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the pottery and poetry of an amazing man named Dave. Born into slavery around 1801, Dave became a potter who signed his work and sometimes inscribed his jars with poems. Many of the pots and jars Dave made are found today in museums. Dave signed his work and inscribed his poems at a time when slave literacy was much feared. In December of 1834, 6 months after Dave first inscribed a word on a pot he made, the state of South Carolina passed a harsh anti-literacy law. Like most slaves, Dave was known only by his given name. It remained his only name for most of his life. He had 6 documented owners during his lifetime, all of whom were related. Our guest this afternoon, Leonard Todd, is descended from the family who owned Dave. Leonard Todd is the great-great-grandson of Dave's principal owner, Lewis Miles. Leonard Todd learned of his family's connection to Dave by chance. That chance was to lead him on a journey to learn more about his family and the slave named Dave. He wanted to tell Dave's story. Leonard Todd tells the story in Carolina Clay, The Life and Legend of the Slave Potter Dave. Leonard Todd is the author of 4 books, a graduate of Yale College and the Yale School of Art and Architecture. He lived for many years in New York City, where he was a writer and a graphic designer. He now makes his home in Edgefield, South Carolina. Carolina Clay, The Life and Legend of the Slave Potter Dave, is published by W.W. Norton. Leonard Todd, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Celeste. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. I want you to tell the story of your chance encounter with Dave's name, but first, I'd like you to give listeners some sense of how amazing it was for Dave to sign his work.
Well, it was not only amazing, it was unheard of. It had never happened before in all of the history of Edgefield pottery. And it never happened to a slave after Dave either. It was a unique situation that I deal with at length in my book, because being able to sign his pottery gave Dave, a slave, the opportunity to take creative ownership of his work. And this was unheard of.
It also gave him a voice. On June 12, 1834, he inscribed the first word on a pot he made. What was the word?
The word was a beautiful, wonderful, involved word, concatenation, which comes from the Latin catena, which means a linking together, as in the chains that held slaves in bondage. And we can't really know whether Dave was referring to his own slavery with this word, but whether he was or not, it was a stunning word with which to open his conversation with the world, which he was beginning on his jars.
And what would people of the day have made of such inscriptions made by a slave?
Well, just coming upon them as, and not knowing Dave, as many people would not have known who wrote this. They would see his name, they would see the inscription, but they wouldn't personally know him because his pots were distributed all across the South. I'm sure he was a complete mystery to them. What I imagine is that when other slaves saw his inscriptions, they probably could not read them because it was very difficult for a slave to find a way to learn to read in those days. But I imagine when they saw a work of art, really, though they might not have identified it that way, but a fine work by an artisan who was clearly a slave and who had signed it and who had written something on it, I imagine that the other slaves were given courage by this, that they too could dare to do something like that, could hold their heads high like Dave did, even though they were yoked by bondage.
Mm-hmm. You think he longed deeply to read. Why?
That he wanted deeply to read,
yes.
Is that what you said?
Yes.
Oh, I think he did. I think many, many slaves did from the earliest days of slavery. We have stories of slaves, one in particular, James Groniosaw, who was the slave of a ship captain. And he writes in his autobiography, which he wrote years after he was no longer a slave, he wrote that when his owner first read from the Bible to the crew of the ship, James Groniosaw, the slave, was so amazed by this that he thought the book was talking through his master. And when he had a moment when he could secretly open the book himself, he opened the Bible and put his head, his ear down to the pages of the book in hopes that it would speak to him as well. And he was gravely disappointed, of course, when it wouldn't. So even from those early days of slavery, that was in the 18th century, on through Dave's time in the 19th century, slaves yearned to be able to make the book talk, as they called it. And Dave took great risks and was able to learn to read. I think the way he learned to read, I can't be sure of this, but I think his owner, his first owner, Harvey Drake, taught him how to read because he wanted him to be able to read the Bible and find salvation in the Bible. Harvey was a very religious man.
Yeah, he is an interesting figure in this story, and eventually Dave would take the name Drake.
That's correct. And many slaves after the Civil War took the name of their first owner, not necessarily as a way of honoring that owner, but simply as a way of identifying themselves. That, yes, I'm Dave, who once belonged to the Drake family. And that's the way they were able to give themselves a personal history.
Yeah, he could have taken another name, though, couldn't he? I mean, he was owned by others in the family.
Yes, but I think the reason, there were several reasons, potential reasons for taking the name Drake. One that is probably the real reason is that while he lived with the Drakes, or just after he was sold by the Drakes went west to Louisiana, and many, many of Dave's friends and perhaps loved ones were taken with them as their slaves. And so Dave might have wanted to identify himself as a Drake so that if any of those former slaves and loved ones made their way back after the Civil War, they might be able to find him that way.
Yeah. I never thought of emigration in such heartbreaking terms.
Can you imagine? I mean, really, they the slaves, when their owners decided to move west, and it's known today as the second, crossing. It was even worse in some ways than the crossing from Africa because there were so many more slaves involved, the second middle crossing. And they were taken completely against their, or not given any choice whatsoever, and taken from the states along the eastern seaboard into Louisiana and then on into Texas. And they had no way of communicating with those they had left behind. They couldn't read the newspapers. They couldn't write. They were in limbo and had to just leave their homes and their loved ones virtually forever.
Hmm. Well, now let's go back to the point where it was that you first came across Dave's name. Tell us that story.
Well, I remember the exact date, actually, when I first learned of Dave. It was January 30th, 2000. I was in New York City, where I had lived for almost 30 years, though I had been born in the South, in South Carolina, actually, in a city named Greenville, and raised there before moving north. But I opened the New York Times on that morning, and I found an article on a slave potter named Dave, and I saw that he had lived in South Carolina, and I thought, how interesting, and I read through about the wonderful pots that he made, about the fact that he signed them with his name, and that he wrote poems on them. And, however, it was the last paragraph that took my breath away, because there his owners were identified, and I recognized them as my ancestors in South Carolina. And this was something I knew absolutely nothing about. I didn't know that my family had been pottery manufacturers. I knew only that they lived in Edgefield, South Carolina, a small town I'd never been to. And I didn't know that they were pottery manufacturers. And I vaguely knew that they must have been slave owners. But like many Southerners, it was information that was just sort of in the air, and I knew no details of it. And it seemed long ago and far away. But now, all of a sudden, because of that article, I knew for sure that they were slave owners, and for sure that here was a real person with a real name, and a person somewhat like myself, because I had always, during my life, been in the arts. I had been a painter and studied architecture, and I was a writer. And here was a man who was a wonderful potter, who loved the feel and the look of beautiful objects. And I recognized a kinship with him, a spiritual kinship, and yet he had been owned by my ancestors. And it was a very shocking realization to find all this out in one morning there in the year 2000.
Hmm. As a designer, a painter, someone who studied architecture, can you describe for us the pots, the jars that Dave made? Can you give us some sense of them? There are photographs in the book, and they're beautiful. But the unfortunate thing about radio is we only have words, and sounds. So you want to give it your best shot.
I'll give it my best shot, of course. And also I should say that on my website there are beautiful photographs of Dave's pots. And my website address is leonardtodd.com. So your listeners could perhaps go there and see his images of them as well. But the best way to describe them is that they are, first of all, utilitarian pots, because that's what my family was manufacturing, were pots for the plantations and farms and homes of the South. They didn't have refrigeration. They didn't have tin cans. They didn't have glass mason jars. All they had was pottery to store meat in and to hold liquids and to churn milk in and so forth. So that's what Dave made. But he brought something more to his work, and that was this great skill that he had with shaping the clay and also making it bigger than anyone else had been able to do. He made the largest jars that are known in, from the Edgefield tradition. They could hold up to 40 gallons, which is tremendously big. The Charleston Museum in Charleston, South Carolina, has two pots that Dave made in one day, each of which holds 40 gallons, and they're displayed side by side, and it's just amazing to see them. But the jars ranged in size from those very large ones that I just described down through churns and jugs and pitchers that were really quite small. The shapes, there are only maybe four or five basic shapes for them, which are not unusual. Those were the traditional shapes of Edgefield pots. But what made Dave's jars so interesting were the glazes that he put on them, which changed from kiln to kiln as he moved through his life and had six different owners, and each one had a different kiln and different ways of firing their works. So the heat that was used in a certain way in a certain kiln would affect the glaze in a certain way, and the color would be changed. And so Dave's pots vary from a beautiful celadon green through a sort of hay-colored cream through a rich brown to almost solid black toward the end of his life. And sometimes the glazes are runny, which gives one kind of texture. Sometimes they are solid in color, which gives another texture. So they vary a great deal in appearance, but they are all have this wonderful presence that's really quite appealing and can be stunning. When you're alone with a Dave jar, you can almost commune with him as the creator of that jar.
Yeah. And give us a sense for how his handwriting looks on these jars.
His handwriting is inscribed into the damp clay of the jar just after he finishes turning a piece. He takes a pointed stick and inscribes in very loose but elegant cursive handwriting his poem or his signature, and it's all very self-assured looking. For the most part, his early inscriptions, interestingly enough, are not self-assured. There's one at the State Museum in Columbia, South Carolina, that's, I think it's his very first poem that we know of, and it's all scrunched, if I can use that word, over into up against the handle as if he were not at all sure of what he was doing. And his later poems are spread all the way around the side of a pot with great self-assurance. So he became more accustomed to, one, to writing in clay, but also I think he gained confidence that he could do it and that what he was writing was worthwhile.
Mm. The first time he put a word on a pot, it was concatenation. When was the first rhyme he put on a pot, and what was it, or a jar?
Yes, it was shortly thereafter. It was a month later, and it was the one that I just spoke of that was all pinched up in the corner. Put every bit all between. Surely this jar will hold 14. And those were actually instructions to the user of the pot. Pack this 14-gallon jar with fresh meat. Pack it tightly with fresh meat. And every Edgefieldian would have understood that.
Hmm. And there are poems then that come later that are quite moving. Would you share one or two of those with us?
Sure. Well, there's... I can put together several poems that tell a little bit about Dave's personal life, which was a very tragic personal life, if I may do that. He was, in the middle part of his life, he was moved to a new plantation on the far side of the district, and there he was thrown in to a whole new group of other slaves, and found apparently a woman that pleased him a great deal in this new group of slaves, and he addressed two poems to her in 1840. One was, "What's better than kissing while we both are at fishing?" Which is funny and amusing, and I'm sure charmed her a great deal. And then the second one, which he wrote just a few months later, "Another trick is worse than this. Dearest miss, spare me a kiss." So clearly Dave was smitten by this woman that he had met at his new home, and he was wooing her through his poetry on his jars. And my research, I believe, shows that her name was Louisa and that they had six children together over the next 10 years. Unfortunately and tragically, at the end of that 10 years, the whole family was broken up and sold to different masters. Dave, Louisa, and the children all went to different masters. And it was a dreadful day. It happened when Reverend John Landrum, one of my ancestors, died, and the family sold all of the slaves, and Dave and his family, according to my research, were all sold. A few years after that, Dave wrote a third poem, which I believe was looking back at that terrible day, and when he lost all of his loved ones. And the poem was, "I wonder where is all my relation, friendship to all and every nation."
Hmm. As a researcher and as someone whose family is involved in this story, how do you figure out what these poems mean? How do you put them into context? How are they clearly about something that you can link to events and places and people? And then where do they leave you wondering, what could this have meant?
Well, one of the first things I did when I began to research Dave's life was to establish a timeline of events that affected Dave. I put every event that I could document in his own life things that we knew from documents and records already. Then I put every event that I knew of that from my family record, the people who owned Dave. And then I put the events from the community and from the state and from the South. I put all of these in my computer in a timeline. And then into this timeline, I put all of Dave's poems, which, thank goodness, were all dated. And so I could see what Dave was saying in a particular context. I could see what had just happened before he wrote a particular poem and what just happened after and so forth, so that his poems were no longer just floating words. They were anchored firmly in a historical context. So this helped me a great deal to, not in every case, but in some cases, to understand what Dave might have been saying. We can't ever be sure about these things, but it helped me to make a more educated guess about what a poem's meaning might have been.
Hmm. In July, at the end of July 1840, I believe, we have a pot with this rhyme, "Dave belongs to Mr. Miles, where the oven bakes and the pot biles."
Yes, that is such an amazing poem to me because, and this was one of the first poems that I read by Dave, because here Dave belongs to Mr. Miles. He's referring to my great-great-grandfather, mm-hmm. Lewis Miles. And what is he saying here? Is he truly accepting the idea that he is enslaved to Lewis Miles? Or is he perhaps currying favor with Lewis Miles? What is going on here? And do you know, I have to say that I do not know.
Mm-hmm.
After all of this study, I still don't know what Dave actually is implying with this. What I think, and I have to say that it's a guess on my part, from what I've been able to understand about the relationship between Dave and Lewis Miles, I think that Dave, in the language of slavery, in the context of slavery, is acknowledging a special link between himself and Lewis Miles. Not one necessarily of master and slave, but I'm going to say friendship. I know that this is highly suspect because I'm a member of Mr. Miles' family, and maybe I want things to look as good for my family, who were slave owners, as possible. I understand that I'm not to be trusted here. But this is what I think, and I'll tell you why I think this. A pot has come to light that is actually a jug, and it has an exaggerated handle on it. And Dave has written on the side of this jug, LM, which stands for Lewis Miles. LM says this handle will crack, which is he's pointing out to the person, whoever buys this pot, that Lewis Miles says this will crack. I don't think it will crack. We've made a wager about this. Buy it and see whether it cracks or not. That's basically what he's saying there. And of course, all these many years later, the handle is not cracked. It's in perfect shape. But the fact that Dave felt free enough to write that about his master on the pot, and that his master, Lewis Miles, felt free enough to let it stand, means to me that there was a trust between these two men and a friendship. Now, I could be so wrong about this, but that's what I believe, and that's what my research has led me to think.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Leonard Todd. We're talking today about the pottery and poetry of a man named Dave. He was born into slavery sometime around 1801. He became a potter who signed his work and sometimes inscribed his jars and pots with poems. And many of these pots and jars now are found in museums. Our guest this afternoon, Leonard Todd, is descended from the family who owned Dave. Leonard Todd is the great-great-grandson of Dave's principal owner, Lewis Miles. Leonard Todd tells the story in Carolina Clay, The Life and Legend of the Slave Potter Dave. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. One of the things I want to talk with you about is a relative by the name of Abner Landrum. He was a man apparently passionate about pottery, and he also came to own a newspaper, The Hive, and Dave worked there for a time. What did he do?
Well, he probably did all of the heavy lifting jobs at the newspaper. Abner Landrum was an extremely intelligent man and one of the most erudite men in that whole part of South Carolina. He had a group of friends around him who were very educated and who held discussions in the manner of groups like that explored the theory of the deterioration of heat and light and scientific questions and very, very interesting discussions. And Dave would have heard all of this in the offices of the Hive as he went about his duties there. And I believe that this is where his ability to use big, important words like concatenation came from. I think he probably overheard that word during these discussions at the Hive. So I see the time that Dave spent there working at the newspaper as a continuation of his education.
Again, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Again, our guest, Leonard Todd. Let's take a call now from a listener joining us on line 4 from Morris, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say first that thank you for such a poignant and touching story. I'm just fascinated. So I'll ask two questions, if I may, and then take them on the air. The first one is, did he ever, as far as you know, see his wife or the mother of his children or the children again? And two, if you would speculate a little bit, what do you think a man like Dave would have been today, a literary artist or a craftsperson, a pottsman? Thank you.
Two great questions, and I'm delighted to say, in answer to the first one, which was, did Dave ever see his wife again, Louisa, I have every reason to believe that he did, and the reason I do is because I've discovered a small book that had belonged to my great-grandfather, Lafayette Weaver, who was Lewis Miles's son-in-law, and in it he kept records of the men that he had hired to work for himself and Lewis Miles after the Civil War, and one of them was Dave, presumably to work in the pottery again. And in addition to that listing, there are details about what Dave bought at the company store run by my ancestors. And one of the things he bought, and this was 1866, just after the war ended, he bought one peck of meal for his wife, in quotation marks, for his wife. So Dave, for sure, we have proof that Dave had a wife, and I believe that it was Louisa who had found her way back to him, because when she was sold in 1847, she was sold to a family who lived perhaps 20 miles away, and I believe that after the war she could have made her way back to Dave, and that his dearest miss found him again, and that was who he bought the peck of meal for. What would Dave be today? I believe, I have never thought of this, but I would imagine that he would be an artisan, again, making wonderful pots. The pots that, I mean, the artisans that I know today stand in awe of Dave's work. So he would be a very, very highly skilled potter today, I think.
Well, tell us here now about Steve Farrell.
Excuse me, I missed that.
Would you tell us here about Steve Farrell? He's a potter.
Yes, yeah. Well, Steve Farrell is a wonderful potter here in Edgefield, South Carolina, who has made it his mission to reproduce as carefully, as completely as possible, the Edgefield pots of the last century, of the 19th century. He makes beautifully decorated pots in the style of Dave and also of some of the other potters from here in Edgefield. I believe he has a website, oldedgefieldpottery.com, and he's a fine fellow, and he helped me a lot with this book because he has a great deal of knowledge, he and his father, Terry Farrell, both.
Tell us about the trip you took with him out to Pottersville when you I don't know if it was your first or an early foray into Edgefield, South Carolina.
Yes, Steve acted as my guide that day and took me to the first kiln site where Dave had made his pots. It was a community just a mile from the little town of Edgefield. It was called Pottersville, and it has completely disappeared today. But the ruins of the furnace where Dave fired his pots is still there near the crest of a hill. And we were able to walk in the very footsteps, really, of Dave, and on the ground were pieces of broken pots. We were able to walk down the hill to the stream at the base where they for a while at least, dug the clay and hauled it up to the factory up near the road. It was so moving to be there, and Steve acted as my guide and was able to recreate how it must have been when Dave was there.
Mm-hmm. What would the place have been like in its heyday?
Well, it would have been that spot, and then the other pottery locations where Dave worked were very, very busy work yards. Slaves would have been digging clay and hauling it up to be dried in the shed, and then the turners would take it from the shed and put it on their wheels, and the wheels would be turning, and then they would cut them off of the wheel, and they would dry them in the sun, and then they would dip them in the glaze, and then they would burn them in the furnace. And it must have been quite amazing to see that. And in fact, the townspeople, when there would be a firing of the pots at Pottersville once every 2 weeks, and the people from Edgefield and the surrounding area would come to watch this because it was a magnificent display. It would take place over the course of 12 to 18 hours. The slave potters would build up the fire in this long furnace that was called a groundhog kiln, K-I-L-N. And the reason it was called that was because it was partly dug into a hillside and had an opening in the front and looked like the burrow of some giant animal. And it was perhaps 10 feet wide by 20 feet long and had a completely enclosed vaulted roof. And at the far end was a chimney. So all of the raw clay ware was in the middle of the furnace. The fire was in this end. The chimney was at the other end, and so the heat would be pulled across that raw clayware for 12 to 18 hours. Abner Landrum, or Harvey Drake, would have been there instructing the workers in how to raise the temperature, to keep building it slowly. And at the end of the 18 hours, they would pack as much wood into the fire as they possibly could, and flames would erupt, sheets of flame would erupt from the chimney in this magnificent display, and it would usually then by then be nightfall, and all of the townspeople would be there watching and admiring, and that would go on for 2 hours, during which this raw clay ware would become stoneware. And it was amazing to see. And then 2 days later, they would, after it was cool, they would bring it out and sell it right there.
And the remains of the kiln that Dave used are there. Are archaeologists interested in this site?
Fascinated by this site, yes. And they have visited it and the others. There have been studies made, and I'm hoping that there will be more work done on them, because there's much still to learn about them.
I want to go back to Dave and the hive and his participation, albeit kind of on the edge, in the day's events. One of the events of the day that they had to be talking about at the time was, the great, what came to be called the Great Reaction. It included the passage in 1834 of this harsh anti-literacy law. And this was a dangerous time, but Dave would not be anonymous. He made himself known, and here again we have to speculate, but that's really interesting.
It's fascinating. The slave owners of South Carolina became very upset and worried after Nat Turner's rebellion in Virginia in 1831, and they passed a severe anti-slave literacy law, because the connection is because Nat Turner was a literate slave who quoted verses from the Bible to convince the other slaves to join him in this very bloody rebellion. And so the slave owners in South Carolina were very much afraid that that might happen in their state, and they wanted to cut off the possibility that their slaves would be able to have access to the Bible or access to words and ideas and anything that might make them less a slave and more a danger to the status quo. So, at any rate, they passed this law in 1834 that made it a crime to teach slaves to read or to write. And it was a time of great repression. Former slaves report in interviews that they were severely beaten if they were found with a pencil or pencil and paper or with a book. Some slaves reported being threatened with having their forefinger cut off if they learned to write. So you would think that Dave, who already knew how to write and was literate by that time, would sort of withdraw and hide this ability because of the danger associated with it. But instead, he made himself one of the best-known slaves in the district. He very publicly wrote on his jars. He used very large words like concatenation, and magnanimous was a word he used, and corporosity. And even the editor of the Edgefield Advertiser, the newspaper, spoke of him as using impressive words, and spoke of the intelligent twinkle in his eye. So Dave made his education public. He made these wonderful jars. He invited people to watch him at his wheel. He made these rhymes. He made himself very well known. And if he did this in a conscious effort to protect himself from the men who would potentially harm him, it worked brilliantly. By hiding nothing, he seems to have been able to do almost anything.
Hmm. One of the things I found fascinating early in the book, that when you first went to Edgefield, South Carolina, Dave is remembered on the town's history wall.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that unusual?
I think it's unusual to have a history wall.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, in a town monument, I mean, I don't know what the history wall really looks like.
It's like a monument, yeah. Yes, yeah. But it's a modern one. It's not something that's been there for many years. It's been there about 10 years. But several people from the town history are remembered. Most of them, however, were famous murderers and duelists, and Dave is within that group. So it's a somewhat questionable group, but it's an honor just the same. And Abner Landrum is on that list, remembered on the history wall. And when I first came there, that was one of the guideposts for me, was that when I walked up and found Dave's name and my ancestor's name linked together, I knew I was in the right place.
Mm. So maybe this is Edgefield trying to say, hey, world, we've got a great history. We're a colorful lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very proud of being colorful. It's true. And it is an incredibly colorful history.
Yeah.
Edgefield history is amazing, and one of the things that drew me to this town.
Yeah, and now you're a resident.
I'm a resident.
Yeah.
I know. My wife and I came here when I first began my research, and both just fell in love with this town and decided to leave Manhattan, where we had lived for 30 years, and in search of adventure, move here to Edgefield, which we did, and we've been very happy that we did so.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon, Leonard Todd, and I would say to our listeners that there's much more to this story. You'll find it in Leonard Todd's book, Carolina Clay, The Life and Legend of the Slave Potter. Dave, the publisher, is W.W. Norton, and our guest has a website, his last name spelled Todd, T-O-D-D, T-O-D-D, LeonardTodd.com. Leonard Todd, thank you.
Thank you very much, Celeste.
It's 1:53. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. That interview with Leonard Todd was conducted on November 4th of last year. Let's find out now what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago with the commodity markets. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. Take a look at those numbers as they settled in Chicago on this Thursday afternoon. Futures in the wheat pit, 0.75 cents lower for the nearby March soft red, a 6.20 3/4 high, low at 5.98. Settlement price there down 0.75 cents. March wheat at 6.12 1/2 at the end of the day. May futures 6.32 1/4, the high, the low at 6.12 1/4. Settlement price at 6.25 1/2, a half lower. And July wheat, 6.43 3/4, the high, the low at 23 3/4. The new crop settled down a penny at 6.36 1/4 for July soft red. September there at 6.56 1/4 in Chicago, down a penny. From Kansas City, March contract 3 3/4 lower, and the July hard red down 3 3/4, settlement at 6.54 1/4. Spring wheat settled the nearby March at 6.25 1/4, down 5 3/4. From the corn pit in Chicago, a $4.18 1/2 high for the March contract. The low at 4.05 3/4, settlement price down 9 3/4 cents at 4.06 3/4. May futures a dime lower, 4.28 1/2, the high, the low at 4.16 1/2, settlement price at 4.17 1/4, down a dime. And July futures 4.38 1/2, the high, the low at 26 3/4, settlement price at $4.27 1/2, down 9 3/4 cents. September corn 4.37 1/2, down 9 3/4, and your December contract, the new crop at 4.61 1/2, top bottom at 4.50, settlement price at $4.50 1/4, down 10 1/4 for the December corn of 2009. March 09 corn at 4, or rather March 10 corn at 4.62, it finished down a dime on the afternoon. March note, futures 223, a penny higher. The May contract at 232.5, up 1 cent on the day. Soy complex, January beans, $10.5 the high, or rather $10.4 the high. The low at 978.5, a settlement price at $9.89, down a penny on the day. March futures, $10.05 for the high, the low at 976.25. Settlement price, 989.5, down 0.5 cents. May futures, 10.15, the high, the low at 988. Settlement price, 10 bucks even for the May soybean, down 1. July futures, 10.26.5, the high, the low at 998.5. Settlement price at $10.11, down 3/4. And the November 2009 soybean futures, 10.19, the high, the low at 991.75. Settlement price at $10.01. Down 5 cents for Nov soybeans. January bean meal settled at $2.99, up $4 for the day, with a high of $3.01.50, a low at $2.93.30, a settlement price at $299 a ton, up $4 for the January bean meal. The March contract at $2.98.30, up $2.80. January bean oil, 40 cents the loss. $35.91 the high, the low at $35.35. January bean oil settled down 40 at $35.52. The March at $35.78. Finished down 40 cents as well. Over at the Mercantile Exchange side with the livestock, $83.15 was the settlement price for that February live contract. In the cattle, $85.87.5 the high, the low at $83.10. Settlement price at $83.15. Once again, down $2.62.5 for the Feb live cattle. April futures, $89.25 the high, the low at $86.90. Settlement price, $86.95, $1.97.5 lower. June contract, $86.85, the high, the low at $85.25. Settlement price at $85.37.5, down $1.07.5 in the August live cattle. $87.35 on the high, the low at $85.90. Settled at $86.10, down 85 cents. January feeder cattle, down $1.00 $94.70. The high, the low at $93.15. Settlement price at $93.50 from the CME Group. Up dollar lower for the January feeder cattle. The March contract now, $93.75, the high, the low at $91.90. Settled $92.25, $1.25 lower in the April feeders. $95 the high, the low at $93.10. Settlement price, $93.50, 77.5 cents lower. May contract, $96.25, the high, the low at $94.60. Settled at $94.92.5, down 1.17.5. February lean hog, $63.55, the high, the low at $62.10. Settled 62.42.5, down $1.12.5. April futures 70.50, the high, the low at 68.80. Settlement price is $69.05, down $1.20 in the May contract. 80.97.5 for the lean hogs on the high, the low at 80.40. Settled at 80.97.5, down 20 cents for the lean hog futures. June contract 82.12.5, the high, the low at 81.10. Settlement price $81.55, 100 weight down 17. And a half cents. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time this afternoon. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, our technical director, Jason Croft, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In Illinois, mostly sunny. In western Indiana, a mix of clouds and sunshine. Elsewhere in Indiana, mostly cloudy with scattered light snow showers and flurries. Highs ranging from 18 in far northern Illinois to 38 in the far south. Tonight in northern Illinois, increasing cloudiness with light snow arriving after midnight. In northern Indiana, mostly cloudy with a few flurries. In central and southern sections, partly cloudy, lows ranging from 10 in far northwestern Illinois to 25 in the far south. Tomorrow in the north and in central Indiana, cloudy with snow showers. Elsewhere, a mix of clouds and sunshine, highs ranging from 28 in northeastern Indiana to 50 in southwestern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly sunny and cold, the high 25, the wind from the west at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low 17, the wind shifting from southwesterly to southeasterly at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny, breezy, not as cold tomorrow, the high